he said. I'm no longer scanning. The officer glanced across at him, smiled uneasily. Hey, no sweat. I can handle the idea of heads. Just doing your job, after all. Vaughn smiled. He recalled the words of a fellow Psi-positive at the Ottawa Institute 10 years ago. Prepare yourself for a lonely life, bud. No one likes a telepath. The officer dropped him off at Terminal 3. Vaughn climbed from the car and began walking towards the building, and the officer watched him all the way, just carrying out orders. He entered the office and, ignoring the three clerks busy at their screens, crossed to the bank of terminals ranked beneath the windows, overlooking the deck. He accessed the report files he'd been completing over the past week and feigned diligence. From time to time, he glanced over the screen and watched the activity in the glare of halogen lights around the freighter. The numerous service teams performed their duties and departed. The Bowser finished first, sucking the excess fuel from the tanks and then trundling off across the port, lights flashing. Teams of engineers came and went, disappearing beneath the underbelly of the freighter to perform their routine checks. Technicians swarmed over the carapace of the ship, expertly utilizing the purpose-built footholds in the sloping flanks. As he watched, a shuttle beetled out from the terminal building beneath him and zipped across the deck, pulling up before the ramp and waiting patiently. Minutes later, the crew disembarked, 10 men and women in the stylish black and silver uniforms of the Vega line. They boarded the shuttle, and it looped around the ship and headed back towards the terminal. Vaughn stood and stretched, then casually left the office. He strolled across the deck, heading away from the Vegan freighter. To his right, the officer's roadster was parked outside the security wing of the terminal building. Vaughn increased his pace, putting the bulk of a void liner between him and the terminal. He turned and made his way towards the freighter. As he walked through the humid night, he slipped his pin from its case and inserted it into his skull console. Although he often strolled around the deck between jobs, and his presence here tonight would not be considered amiss, he nevertheless felt self-conscious, as if the few engineers and security guards he passed were aware of his intentions. Swift scans told him that their thoughts were as banal as ever. He approached the freighter, becalmed now in the aftermath of its landing. He made sure that he went unobserved. It was not within his remit to board ships through their emergency exits. The coast was clear. There was no one in the vicinity, other than a team of engineers busy working on a nearby ship, and they were too engrossed in their work to notice him. He hurried to the lip of the berth and descended a ladder into the shadowy pit beneath the belly of the freighter. He paused, regaining his breath and his composure. That was the first stage of the operation, successfully completed. All that remained now was to board the ship. He scanned, probing behind the sleek, curved lines of the freighter. He detected a single mind, too high up in the ship to be read with any clarity. He found the emergency exit cover and tapped the entry code into the lock. The cover slid open, extruding steps. He climbed into a small, darkened compartment. At his presence, sensors activated, and a hatch above him slid open. Low lights came on, illuminating a corridor. He hauled himself into the ship and stood. He was in the working end of the freighter. The corridor was spartan, uncarpeted. He set off in the direction of where he judged the cargo hold to be. First, he would inspect whatever goods the ship was hauling. Later, he would investigate the source of the distant mind noise in the crew cabins high above. The cargo holds were situated on either side of the corridor. He pressed the sensor panel on the hatch to his left, and the hatch eased open to reveal a small, dimly lit hold, empty but for hauling trolleys and lifting equipment. He closed the hatch and crossed the corridor, palming the sensor on the opposite hatch. The dull steel cover slid open, and Vaughn saw that this hold was occupied. He stepped into the vaulted chamber, poorly illuminated by sporadic strip fluorescence. A bulky oval case stood in the center of the bare steel floor. The case was the approximate size of a flyer, shoulder high at the rear, sloping to around waist high where Vaughn stood. It seemed to be constructed of some brass or copper-like material, engraved with an intricate pattern of spiral and curlicue striations. He walked around the case. The random design of whorls was repeated on every facet, and nowhere could he make out a seal, lid, or hatch. The most remarkable aspect of the casing, however, was the fact that it was shielded. When he scanned, he detected the signature static that denoted a powerful mind shield. He touched the cold surface of the case, laid his cheek against the inscribed patterning surface. He scanned again, read nothing. He backed off a pace, contemplating the case and wondering what it contained. If Weiss was transporting illegal immigrants to Earth from Vega, why do so like this? Why not just have them travel as foot passengers? Animals, then. Was Weiss smuggling some proscribed species of fauna to Earth? But if so, why? There had been two earlier freighters Weiss had warned him off. Vaughn wondered how many shielded containers Weiss had successfully smuggled into the station. He recalled the mine situated high above him. As he hurried from the cargo hold and took the elevator to the upper decks, it occurred to him that he should have felt pleased that he had uncovered the illegal operation, satisfied that a hunch had hit the jackpot. Instead, he experienced a subtle uneasiness at the discovery and its ramifications. As the elevator climbed, the contents of the mind above him came into focus. He realized that it was the mind of a child, a young girl, and that she was distressed. The lift door opened onto the third floor. A red-tiled corridor dwindled into the distance, archways opening onto other passages at regular intervals. He set off at a jog along the main corridor. The cerebral signature became louder as he ran, then modulated almost imperceptibly. He had passed the turning down which the kid was located. He retraced his steps, took the turning. The mind cried out, "Help! Someone please help me!" Even as he moved towards the girl, something told him to ignore the cry and leave the ship now. He tried to analyze the desire. The cry was human, in need of help, and yet his initial impulse was to run. He arrived at an archway leading into a bedchamber. The girl was in the room, hiding in a storage unit. Vaughn stepped into the room, crossed to the stack of units. He touched the control panel on the unit, and the door whirred open. A young girl, perhaps 10 years old, hugged her shins and stared at him. She had straight, dark hair, brown eyes. Her resemblance to Holly struck him like a blow. He probed and found her name, Ellie Jensen. He knelt before her, trying to block her sudden surge of fright, and held out a hand. "Please, don't be frightened. I can help." She whispered, "Who are you?" "Don't worry. I'll get you out of here. Please, trust me." He probed, and her mind entered his in a kaleidoscopic whirl of fragmented images. He sorted through them, discarding extraneous thoughts and memories, picking out only what he needed to know. He shared her fear, her memories of life on Verkirk's world. He identified the image of her father and read her incomprehension at why he had allowed her to be taken away. He relived the day two strangers came to her father's house and took her, and shared with the girl her bewilderment when her father tried to explain that she had been chosen and must go. He reached out for the girl's hand. She flinched at his touch, but did not pull away. She watched him with wide eyes, wanting to trust him, and yet fearing to do so. "I'm not with the people who took you," he said. He sensed that part of her confusion was that she did not know where she was. She had been told that she was going to Earth, but her young mind had been unable to encompass the idea. He said, "You're on Earth now. You came through the void from your world. I want to help you. Please, take me home. Can you take me home? The words were clean and sharp with the ice of Scandinavian intonation. Please, take me away from here. He thought through the situation, considered his options. He could always take her from the ship, back through the emergency exit, then contact Chandra and deliver her into the care of the police. He wondered if the presence of the shielded container and Ellie Jensen aboard the freighter was anything more than a coincidence. He scanned her again, tried to read the whereabouts of the people who had escorted her to Earth. He read a name, Fredrickson, caught the image of a man in the black and silver uniform of the Vega Company. He took Ellie's hand and pulled her to her feet. It's okay, Ellie. You're safe now. Something in her wide-eyed expression of surprise alerted him. Vaughn tried to turn, to follow the direction of her gaze, but the neural incapacitator hid him before he caught sight of his assailant. He arched as voltage stabbed him in the back and coursed through his body.
Chapter 6. The Noble and Most Ancient House of Black. Mrs. Weasley followed them upstairs, looking grim. "I want you all to go straight to bed, no talking," she said, as they reached the first landing. "We've got a busy day tomorrow. I expect Ginny's asleep," she added to Hermione, "so try not to wake her up."
"Asleep, yeah, right," said Fred in an undertone, after Hermione bade them good night and they were climbing to the next floor. "If Ginny's not lying awake waiting for Hermione to tell her everything they said downstairs, then I'm a flobberworm."
"All right, Ron, Harry," said Mrs. Weasley on the second landing, pointing them into their bedroom. "Off to bed with you."
"Night," Harry and Ron said to the twins.
"Sleep tight," said Fred, winking.
Mrs. Weasley closed the door behind Harry with a sharp snap. The bedroom looked, if anything, even danker and gloomier than it had on first sight. The blank picture on the wall was now breathing very slowly and deeply, as though its invisible occupant was asleep. Harry put on his pyjamas, took off his glasses, and climbed into his chilly bed, while Ron threw owl treats up on top of the wardrobe to pacify Hedwig and Pigwidgeon, who were clattering around and rustling their wings restlessly.
"We can't let them out to hunt every night," Ron explained as he pulled on his maroon pyjamas. "Dumbledore doesn't want too many owls swooping around the square. Thinks it'll look suspicious."
"Oh, yeah, I forgot." He crossed to the door and bolted it.
"What are you doing that for?"
"Creature," said Ron as he turned off the light. "First night I was here, he came wandering in at 3 in the morning. Trust me, you don't want to wake up and find him prowling around your room." Anyway, he got into his bed, settled down under the covers, then turned to look at Harry in the darkness. Harry could see his outline by the moonlight filtering in through the grimy window.
"What do you reckon?"
Harry didn't need to ask what Ron meant.
"Well, they didn't tell us much we couldn't have guessed, did they?" he said, thinking of all that had been said downstairs. "I mean, all they've really said is that the Order's trying to stop people joining Vault..."
There was a sharp intake of breath from Ron.
"Demort," said Harry firmly.
"When are you going to start using his name? Sirius and Lupin do." Ron ignored this last comment.
"Yeah, you're right," he said. "We already knew nearly everything they told us from using the extendable ears. The only new bit was..."
Crack!
"Ouch!"
"Keep your voice down, Ron, or Mum'll be back up here. You two just apparated on my knees."
"Yeah, well, it's harder in the dark."
Harry saw the blurred outlines of Fred and George leaping down from Ron's bed. There was a groan of bedsprings, and Harry's mattress descended a few inches as George sat down near his feet.
"So, got there yet?" said George eagerly.
"The weapon Sirius mentioned," said Harry.
"Let slip, more like," said Fred with relish, now sitting next to Ron. "We didn't hear about that on the old extendables, did we?"
"What do you reckon it is?" said Harry.
"Could be anything," said Fred.
"But there can't be anything worse than the Avada Kedavra curse, can there?" said Ron. "What's worse than death?"
"Maybe it's something that can kill loads of people at once," suggested George.
"Maybe it's some particularly painful way of killing people,"
said Ron fearfully.
"He's got the Cruciatus curse for causing pain," said Harry. "He doesn't need anything more efficient than that."
There was a pause, and Harry knew that the others, like him, were wondering what horrors this weapon could perpetrate.
"So who do you think's got it now?" asked George.
"I hope it's our side," said Ron, sounding slightly nervous. "If it is, Dumbledore's probably keeping it," said Fred.
"Where?" said Ron quickly. "Hogwarts?"
"Bet it is," said George. "That's where he hid the Philosopher's Stone."
"A weapon's going to be a lot bigger than the stone, though," said Ron.
"Not necessarily," said Fred.
"Yeah, size is no guarantee of power," said George.
"Look at Ginny."
"What do you mean?" said Harry.
"You've never been on the receiving end of one of her bat bogey hexes, have you?"
"Shh," said Fred, half rising from the bed.
"Listen."
They fell silent. Footsteps were coming up the stairs.
"Mum," said George, and without further ado, there was a loud crack, and Harry felt the weight vanish from the end of his bed. A few seconds later, they heard the floorboard creak outside their door. Mrs. Weasley was plainly listening to check whether or not they were talking. Hedwig and Pigwidgeon hooted dolefully. The floorboard creaked again, and they heard her heading upstairs to check on Fred and George.
"She doesn't trust us at all, you know," said Ron regretfully.
Harry was sure he would not be able to fall asleep. The evening had been so packed with things to think about that he fully expected to lie awake for hours, mulling it all over. He wanted to continue talking to Ron, but Mrs. Weasley was now creaking back downstairs again, and once she had gone, he distinctly heard others making their way upstairs. In fact, many-legged creatures were cantering softly up and down outside the bedroom door, and Hagrid, the Care of Magical Creatures teacher, was saying,
"Beauties, aren't they, eh, Harry? We'll be studying weapons this term."
And Harry saw that the creatures had cannons for heads and were wheeling to face him. He ducked. The next thing he knew, he was curled into a warm ball under his bedclothes, and George's loud voice was filling the room.
"Mum says get up. Your breakfast is in the kitchen, and then she needs you in the drawing-room. There are loads more doxies than she thought, and she's found a nest of dead puffskeins under the sofa."
Half an hour later, Harry and Ron, who had dressed and breakfasted quickly, entered the drawing-room. A long, high-ceilinged room on the first floor, with olive-green walls covered in dirty tapestries. The carpet exhaled little clouds of dust every time someone put their foot on it, and the long, moss-green velvet curtains were buzzing as though swarming with invisible bees. It was around these that Mrs. Weasley, Hermione, Ginny, Fred and George were grouped, all looking rather peculiar, as they had each tied a cloth over their nose and mouth. Each of them was also holding a large bottle of black liquid with a nozzle at the end.
"Cover your faces and take a spray," Mrs. Weasley said to Harry and Ron the moment she saw them, pointing to two more bottles of black liquid standing on a spindle-legged table. "It's doxicide. I've never seen an infestation this bad. What that house-elf's been doing for the last 10 years!"
Hermione's face was half-concealed by a tea-towel, but Harry distinctly saw her throw a reproachful look at Mrs. Weasley.
"Creature's really old. He probably couldn't manage—"
"You'd be surprised what creature can manage when he wants to, Hermione," said Sirius, who had just entered the room carrying a blood-stained bag of what appeared to be dead rats. "I've just been feeding Buckbeak," he added, in reply to Harry's inquiring look. "I keep him upstairs in my mother's bedroom. Anyway, this writing desk."
He dropped the bag of rats into an armchair, then bent over to examine the locked cabinet, which Harry now noticed for the first time was shaking slightly.
"Well, Molly, I'm pretty sure this is a boggart," said Sirius, peering through the keyhole. "But perhaps we ought to let Mad-Eye have a shifty at it before we let it out. Knowing my mother, it could be something much worse."
"Right you are, Sirius," said Mrs. Weasley.
They were both speaking in carefully light, polite voices that told Harry quite plainly that neither had forgotten their disagreement of the night before. A loud clanging bell sounded from downstairs, followed at once by the cacophony of screams and wails that had been triggered the previous night by Tonks knocking over the umbrella stand.
"I keep telling them not to ring the doorbell," said Sirius exasperatedly, hurrying out of the room.
They heard him thundering down the stairs as Mrs. Black's screeches echoed up through the house once more.
"Stains of dishonour! Filthy half-breeds! Blood traitors! Children of filth!"
"Close the door, please, Harry," said Mrs. Weasley.
Harry took as much time as he dared to close the drawing-room door. He wanted to listen to what was going on downstairs. Sirius had obviously managed to shut the curtains over his mother's portrait because she had stopped screaming. He heard Sirius walking down the hall, then the clattering of the chain on the front door, and then a deep voice he recognised as Kingsley Shacklebolt's, saying,
"Hestia's just relieved me, so she's got Moody's cloak now. Thought I'd leave a report for Dumbledore."
Feeling Mrs. Weasley's eyes on the back of his head, Harry regretfully closed the drawer.